Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming. We're going to begin today with the testifiers, and that will be Joel Ewan.
Madam Chair.
Yep, welcome. State your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Ewan. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I am also the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. I just have to say, with my MS Society hat for just one brief moment, there's a number of people in the audience today. It is our lobby day here at the Capitol, and I just wanted to point out that we have quite a number of people here with MS in the committee today. But with my coalition hat on, I represent a coalition of about 100 disability organizations, and about a third of those organizations are advocacy organizations, and two-thirds of them are provider organizations. And what we are here to do today is present some of our issues that we are working on for this upcoming legislative session. What we want to start off with today is to have a number of testifiers kind of talk about just general disability issues, and so just so the committee members are aware, we're going to be kind of covering a number of different topic areas, I think, for the first 45 minutes or so here today, and then we'll try to, we're going to make sure that we leave time so we can get into a couple of the bills as well. So I just wanted to kind of provide the committee that brief overview, and I think at this point, if Kim Stanley is in the room, I think that is who we were going to have start today.
Thank you, Ms. Stanley. Please state your name for the record. Welcome.
Hi. I usually bring a big picture of Alex with me, but today I'm doing one better. I have both my kids in the flesh. This is Courtney, and Alex is sitting over there. My name is Kim Stanley. I am the mother of two children with special needs. Courtney, 9, has Fragile X, ADHD, anxiety disorder, dyslexia, and learning disabilities. Alex, who is 7, has autism, disruptive behavior disorder, seizures, and OCD. I am a stay-at-home mom that homeschools for reasons that we won't get into today. When I was asked to speak today, about a million things went through my head on what to say. I could tell you how hard it is for our families, but you already know that. I could tell you we need more help than we are getting, but you already know that too. Or I could tell you how you can help, but you already know that. So I decided to talk about all of it just to make sure you really understand what our lives are like and why we really need your help lowering the parental fees for TEFRA. With all that I do and who I am, I do not have time to beat around the bush or sugarcoat anything. So what I am going to say today will be straightforward as to what the legislature needs to do and why. I have heard that there will be a surplus this year, and I am sure everyone has an idea of how to spend it. Transportation is right up there at the top, as is education and health care. All of these are important and affect us all either directly or indirectly. Healthcare happens to affect us very directly. As I said, I have two children with special needs. Raising two spirited typical children is always a challenge, but raising two spirited children with special needs is hard. We have a new legislature in both the House and the Senate this year, and we will also have a lot of children being diagnosed with disabilities this year, both developmental and physical. So what does that mean to our new legislators? A whole lot. In 2003, when some of the legislature decided that the disabled and the elderly were the ones to balance the budget by raising the parental fees and prescription copays, it was one of the most counterproductive moves they could have done. It backfired on them, and we still have had a budget deficit, and a lot of people either dropped TEFRA because they couldn't afford the increased fees, or the families are in debt up to their eyeballs with the state. We are in the latter category. My husband, who is also disabled with a rare muscle disease and fibromyalgia, is working full-time plus to keep a roof over our head and food on the table. We have medical bills, electric, phone, and all the other bills that everyone else has. The difference is our medical bills include our parental fee, as well as any other services that Alice or Courtney may need to help them get the tools and supports that you and I take for granted. When someone says, is your child on a sensory diet? Do you have any idea what that means? Or why is your child behaving like that? Doesn't he have any social skills? The answer is no. These are areas that we have to pay for things out of our pocket. Social skills are not considered medical, but our children cannot survive without it. Society wouldn't have it. As for a sensory diet, that would be a trampoline, monkey bars, fidget toys, or other equipment that helps the sensory system. This equipment is not considered medical, so we have to pay for this out of pocket too. I just got my current invoice in the mail for our CHEFR payment, and we owe the state $6,443.73. We have a payment arrangement with our financial worker because we can't pay the monthly amount the legislators have put on us. Now we are being told that we are not paying enough each month, and our balance is too high, and they have put us on the Minnesota Recapture Program. We are paying the most we can each month, and yet it is not enough. So our state taxes and property taxes will be taken from us. I know you all have a lot to learn and understand, and unless you walk in our shoes or spend time with us, which you are all welcome to do at any time, you will never really understand what our lives are like. So when you have to decide either to pay for transportation needs, education, health care, to name a few, please remember us, and that you can make a difference in our lives and make it a little easier. We are already counting pennies to make ends meet. We are asking you to help us bring the ends closer together. Lower the parental fee to make it more manageable amount for the money we really live on, and maybe even consider reducing or forgiving the families who have large balances due to the 2003 increase. I recently spoke with a couple of families who also have a parental fee that are all, a family in Savage is $3,000 in debt to the state because of parental fees. A family in, another family in Bloomington is $4,000. That's just a couple of people that I've spoken to in the last couple of days. I really would like anybody here that has any questions to ask them, because I know a lot of you are freshmen and this is a very difficult area to understand unless you live it, which we do. So I thank you for your time today, and I'd really like to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stanley. Do we have any questions for Ms. Stanley, members? Representative Temper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Stanley, I'd only simply correct you. A lot of us don't believe there is or is going to be a budget surplus at the end of this biennium, or projected for the next biennium if you include inflation. I want to make that real clear. And many of us are very sympathetic to your needs and concerns. And so we're very concerned about what we consider this misinformation that somehow there's a budget surplus looming out there on the horizon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Temper.
Maybe it's just wishful thinking. It's a rumor.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We just heard testimony that the budget surplus is a rumor or wishful thinking, but in reality it's on paper. So I just wanted to make sure that that was part of the testimony. Whether we include inflation or not is a debate going forward, but there is a budget surplus. The state has over-collected to the tune of about $2 billion.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Thank you, Ms. Stanley.
Thank you.
Would the next testifier please come forward, Darcy and Cassidy Luce, I believe. Am I getting that right? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Darcy Luce, and this is my daughter, Cassidy. Cassidy is 5 years old for a couple more days. She'll be 6 on Friday. She has cerebral palsy. Would it be bad if I switch to the other side? Carol Fury from Assistive Technology of Minnesota called me last week and asked me if I would be willing to come and just tell a little bit about a journey that Cassidy and I have taken. The last 2 years have been a lot of change and steps in the right direction, and we're in a really great place now, and I just kind of want to share the process that you go through, and especially for her and I. I'm a single mom. A couple of years ago went through a normally ugly divorce and lost my mom the same year, and it ended up no money, no credit, and luckily enough for us, we moved in with my dad. But it made for a lot of struggle because I couldn't give her a lot of the things that I really wanted to. I wanted to be able to take her places to help her physically develop so that she could have the best quality of life that she could. And it started getting to the point where we were choosing between going to therapy or she would scream in the car on the way there. We had a tiny little monster protege, and she had a wheelchair that would break down, and we'd stand out in the cold trying to get it together, and it just, she hated it. She hated every time we got in the car, and she would scratch herself in the face, and it was hard to watch her and know that I couldn't do anything about it because there was just, it didn't seem like there were the resources out there, or at least I thought, to really help us through this and to get to a place where we weren't just always needy and wishing that it could be better. And as she got bigger and bigger, it became more and more of an issue. We wouldn't go to the grocery store. It just, we were kind of becoming isolated, and we were frustrated. And my dad finally, after Cassidy got an injury to her leg that resulted from her foot getting caught in part of the car as she was being taken out of the car seat. It was just the last straw for me. And my dad went to the Pacer Center, and he got kind of a booklet of information about different resources that were out there. And I called probably 7 or 8 different places hoping that somebody could help us. And the only person that even contacted me back or had any hope was Assistive Technology in Minnesota. And, you know, when we first started working with her, we were hoping to be able to put the loan in my name and everything and help reestablish some credit. But my dad ended up doing the loan first so that we could get the van and get going in the right direction. And then Carol still kept on it. And a couple months later, she called me and she's like, "We're ready. We're going to get this loan in your name." So we paid off the other one. And, you know, it was just by doing that, it got us into the CAC waiver system. And we got, instead of a vehicle that we could afford with 100,000 miles, you know, it was a brand new vehicle that had a warranty. And that seems so, it was such a big deal to be able to know that she was going to be safe and we weren't going to break down halfway to therapy or whatever. And, you know, I owe that to Assistive Technology, and I know that their loans are directly, they're backed by a grant that they have been given. And, you know, I'm living proof that how important, and it really gives you a fresh start and the ability to kind of start over when it just didn't seem like anybody was willing to help us. So we got on the CAC waiver, and then last year in January, through the MRRC waiver program, they began doing parent PCA pay, and that was the next step for us. We were finally able to get an apartment on our own, and we each had our own bedroom, which was really great because she's a snorer. And I had spent many nights on the couch, so I was really grateful for, you know, it's been such a long journey. And I, when Carol called me last week, she said, "You sound so good." And it made me realize how far we've come in a 2-year period of time. But one of the things that I think I do want to point out is that it's a frustrating program in that there's not enough word out there. People don't know about it. You get little bits and pieces of information, and it would be so helpful if we could just tell people, this is where, you know, you need this, we can help you, and this is where you go. And, you know, you end up getting a lot of doors slammed in your face and along the way, and it just would be helpful to just have a better idea of, you know, where to go when you need help, because, you know, it's out there, you know, and we need to really, really help these kids, because your job as a parent when you have a child with a disability is no different than any other parent. I want her to have the best quality of life and to be happy. And, you know, I'm working really hard to try and make that happen. And I'm really proud of her and how far that we've come. And thank you very much for letting me.
Well, thank you, Darcy and Cassidy. Thank you very much for sharing your...
Thank you.
Yes, sorry. We do have a question. Yes.
Actually, Madam Chair, I don't have a question. I just wanted to wish Cassidy happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I figured she wouldn't forgive me if I didn't mention that her birthday was on
today? Is it today?
It's on Friday.
Oh, happy birthday as well.
Yeah, she's pretty excited. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the next testifier, please come down. And while she is coming down, I will ask for Representative Murphy. Have you read the minutes, and would you approve them, please?
I have. I move the minutes.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
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 The minutes are adopted. And now we have Sherry Farsa. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes. Please identify yourself at the table. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sherry Farsa, and I'm here today speaking on House File Number 706 in favor of extending medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities from age 65 and on. And to point out the importance of this, I will share an experience of mine. I spoke with a social security worker in trying to plan ahead for when I turn 65, and was told by that worker that you are no longer disabled at 65, you are aged. And that was one of the most insensitive things that has ever been said to me. I do not have a visible disability. I have bipolar disorder. Following an episode that led to hospitalization, I lost two professional jobs, one as a consultant to a charter school, the other as an adjunct professor at Augsburg College. I lost my insurance and was declared indigent. Through a county caseworker, it took a year and a half before I became aware of MAEPD, and I was finally put on MAEPD in October of 2003. I turned 65 in September of 2008. I have explored Blue Cross Blue Shield and other carriers, and there is a possibility I would be denied coverage due to my diagnosis, and this would not be uncommon for people with pre-existing conditions. I pay a premium of $214 a month in order to have MEPD. I usher at the Broadway Center for the Performing Arts. My income from there does not cover the premium. Without this insurance coverage, I would continue to have no insurance because I could not afford it privately. My prescription costs per year covered under some of my services are $12,754 a year. I have medication management on a regular basis and health care prevention as part of my costs. I've been hospitalized 3 times, and without this coverage, I would not have been able to pay for those hospitalizations. Other people with disabilities face the same thing at age 65. I believe there are 1,300 of us in the state of Minnesota currently having MAEPD coverage. I believe it should be extended to others who are able to work, and that it should continue from age 65 on, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifier members? Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll call Juanita Clare. Please have a seat and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow committees, for seeing me today. My name is Juanita Clare. I'm an individual. I have one question for you first. I want to know how many of you could live on $604 per month. That's your housing cost, your food, your phone. That is what I live on per month. I'm supporting the bill of 708 of putting a cap on prescription drug costs. I am on Medicare, and I'm also on a prescription Part D program. Right now, with that program, I pay $531 a month out of my pocket for prescription drugs. So what I'm asking is that you would look at the bill for making the cap $1,500 per year on those of us who are not dual eligible. I'm not eligible for medical assistance because I get $1,135 a month. Beyond wealthy, aren't I? I just think that it's time to sit down and look at all of this, and fair is fair. I'm a good citizen. I've worked until I could no longer work. I have done everything I can. I have now depleted most of my assets, which is a very important part of my life and a very important thing I learned from my parents. You save for the future, you save for your retirement. Most of that is now gone. And so I just think we need to really thoroughly look at all of this and sit down. And, you know, I live with $604 a month. That pays a mortgage. That buys my groceries. Going out for dinner is pretty well out the window because the money is not there. So I'd like all of you to sit and seriously think about this, and let's start helping out disabled Americans and helping us out with all of these costs. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier members? Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming. And we have the Reverend Bishop Craig Johnson. Please come.
I did bring photographs today, and so I would like you to, or like to introduce you to my daughter, Laura. I am here today.
Thank you, Reverend. Please state your name for the tape, and then go ahead and testify.
I am Craig Johnson, Bishop of the Minneapolis Area Synod of the Lutheran Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I'm here today in a dual role as Bishop of the Minneapolis Area Synod of the ELCA, which numbers about 225,000 baptized in the Minneapolis area in 167 congregations. The Lutheran Church believes that to stand up for the most vulnerable in our society is a moral value of the Christian Church, which comes to us from the ministry of Jesus. I am also here as a parent that has witnessed the impact of the lack of waivered services and their benefit to disabled persons when they are restored. Our daughter, Laura, who is pictured here, was born in 1983. We knew from the first few weeks that she was struggling with eating and later with crawling and walking and talking. We worked very hard as parents. Probably we overfunctioned to try and help and fix her in those early years. We probably drove her crazy. When she was 2.5, she was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. We immediately qualified for preschool help, and our daughter began part-day schooling at 3 years of age and full-day special education at 6. She continued in special education in the Bloomington District until she was 18, graduating in 2007. Post-high school education was the next step for 2 years until she was 21 years of age. Her socialization until 21 was centered in school life as any other child, but we also supplemented that with relational programs at our church, which my wife had initiated and built. Life was good for our daughter. Waivered services for a person with disabilities in Hennepin County stopped entrance to new clients in 2003. Laura was unable to gain these important funds, which would add to her ability to be a part of the community. Her mother was her best friend. They were always together. Laura's life narrowed. From my vantage point, the biggest challenge persons with disability have is loneliness, vulnerability, and deep financial constraints because of an inability to function in a typical job. Waivered services, which now 4,000 persons are waiting to receive, help to overcome these challenges by providing personal care attendants, which enhance contact with the society. Coaches to enable employment and safety because of close supervision. I worry that we will see someday mentally handicapped people die of exposure because their parents will be unable to supervise them as the parents reach elderly and infirm levels. In 2004, I suffered a hemorrhagic stroke due to a brain aneurysm. That critical event and my 2.5 year recovery allowed our daughter to receive waivered services. We were then able to hire tax-paying personal care attendants that spend 3 days a week for 12 hours. That also allows my wife to now be employed. Our daughter's socialization is growing and growing instead of dwindling and becoming non-existent. Now our challenge is funding for alternative living in group home or similar arrangement. No money is now available. There is a small window of opportunity whereby a young adult with a disability will be able to break away from their parents and reach the highest level of independence possible. The window seems to be in their early 20s when other siblings are going to school and moving out of the home. That would be an impossible expense for almost all families in the long run. Presently, the only way our daughter can consider moving into a group home setting is if a parent dies or becomes disabled. And I personally would not prefer to go through that duty again in order for my daughter to reach that highest level of independence. Plus, a family crisis is not a time to rip someone out of the home, but rather to have a person in a stable place before that event occurs. I would urge you to find ways to fund these extraordinarily important services to our most vulnerable that have such a small voice in our society. So many need your help that do not have two parents or parents that can grasp and gain help from the system. As we grow older, we will worry more and more about the future of our vulnerable children. I support the House File 705 and urge its adoption and your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Reverend. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions from any members? Thank you. And the next testifier, Barb Farster, please come to the table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Bob Farstead. Thank you, Representative Patty Kitts. My name is Bob Farstead, and I am a full-time caregiver for my husband, ex-husband, Bernie, who has Alzheimer's. The reason for my being here today is hopefully to broaden your understanding of what it's like to be a full-time caregiver. I want to spark your imagination as to how you can help us set up programs for networking, support, both financial and emotional, and respite care, which doesn't even exist right now. These are the areas where we need your help. For Bernie and me, November 2nd, 1999, was the day our world was changed forever, and it took only 5 short sentences from Bernie's neurologist. Bernie was diagnosed with dementia of the Alzheimer's type. We were young, by the way. Bernie was in his late 40s, and I was in my late 30s. We were told that there were medications that might slow down the progression of the disease, but with bad luck, we had 1 year. With good luck, 5, before Bernie was in a full-time care institution. We walked out of the neurologist's office that day as if in a bad dream, as if somebody had pushed us out of a 10-story window, free-falling,
try to grasp and have a connection to reality. Bernie and I have been best friends, husband and wife, and business partners for over 20 years. The diagnosis of Alzheimer's has changed all that. Losing the love, your love, to the progression of a disease and giving up a career to care for them changes your roles dramatically. For the caregiver as well as the patient, it alters your sense of self, isolates you from your friends and your community, and is so emotionally devastating, it's hard to stay focused, balanced, and ambitious in any area of your life. Finding out what to do for help has been one of our biggest challenges. The help may be there, but the maze is so confusing, especially when you're emotionally distraught. For example, I found out about adult daycare services at Mount Olivet from my insurance agent, and then found out from someone else that there was only one educational and support group for the patient and caregiver at the University of Minnesota. It's Dr. Wayne Karen's group. He's the only one in the nation, by the way, that has this kind of thing going. We need tons of these, not just one. In my opinion, it would be extremely helpful if before we leave the doctor's office with the diagnosis, that we receive a list of places to call for support and a list of state agencies and departments that could help us. Financially, Bernie's diagnosis came in an early time in our lives before we had our financial feet under us or were able to afford caring for long-term illness. Having your own business with no pensions or retirement funds coming our way, the sale of our store was to be our retirement. I remember going to my first caregiver support group sponsored by the Alzheimer's Association and was told by all 17 people there to get a divorce. These other caregivers were a lot older than me, many of whom were drained of their pensions, their 401ks, and their retirement funds to pay for any nursing home, nursing care, daycare, full-time care of their spouses. Two of them were totally broke. I couldn't believe that this would be true. We went to four elder care lawyers to get their advice, all of whom suggested divorce. It was a costly and time-consuming way to find out how our system works and what you need to do to get the help you need so you don't lose everything. Cognitive and memory impairment diseases and the people who are affected by them slip between the cracks for benefits such as a hospice-type care that is covered by insurance. Furthermore, the places that you do go are not necessarily trained in how to deal with cognitively impaired patients. They are ignored, they are left alone. While they can still think, they have feelings and emotions, they just can't communicate effectively. Educating caregiving aides and home health care workers for the specific disabilities seems vital to me. I asked the Alzheimer's Association if they had a program similar to the Big Brother program. They said, no, but what a good idea. I thought it was a great idea, and it seemed very natural to me, a volunteer program. Maybe the county or the state, you could help us organize a Big Brother-type program for Alzheimer's or cognitive impaired patients. In closing, I would like to thank you, Patty Fritz and Paul Thiessen, for heading up this caregiving bill, and for all the committee members as well for giving me your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions, members, for this testifier? Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And we have the next testifier, Tim Rundahl. Rundahl, please come to the podium.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee. Hello, my name is Tim. I have the honor of being the father of the most courageous young man I have ever met. On September 28th of 2003, my son Adam was in a horrible car accident in northern Minnesota where he sustained a traumatic brain injury. Our journey started with 1 month in the ICU at St. Luke's in Duluth, Minnesota, followed with another month in an ICU in Golden Valley, followed by yet another 4 months of acute rehab in Gillette Children's Hospital. In the beginning of all the hospitalizations, we were told that if Adam lived, he would never wake from the coma he was in. When Adam woke from the coma and he was in a vegetative state, we were told that Adam had a 0% chance of any form of recovery from the vegetative state. When Adam did come out of the vegetative state and started a cognitive recovery, the doctors stopped telling us what the future held for Adam. After 6 months of hospitalization, Adam was released in a wheelchair, labeled a quadriplegic who could no longer eat or speak. He's no longer labeled a quadriplegic. He still cannot eat or speak, but we're working on that. Since then, we've been spent another 6 months in hospitals in 5 different hospitals, anywhere from 4 days to 18 weeks. Today, Adam is able to read and has had a wonderful cognitive recovery, far greater than anyone expected. Adam uses blinks and eyebrow movements and head shakes and head nods to communicate. 3 blinks means I love you, 1 blink for each word. And today on my way here, when I told him I was leaving, and I told him I loved him, he gave me those 3 blinks. Currently, we're not in the hospital. We work with computerized augmented communication so that one day Adam will better be able to communicate with others. After much occupational and physical therapy, although minimal, Adam has regained rough motor skills on his left side, and he is currently regaining motor skills on his right side. Not only has Adam's communication, augmented communication, occupational, and physical therapy produced results, but just as importantly, it has provided a continuing spirit of hope for him and for myself also. Since Adam's accident, I have learned a new language with words such as TBI, atelectus, tick line, pseudomonas, rage of motion, and so on. All these words have different sounds and meanings, but they all have one common denominator, which is medical financial cost. Adam had just turned 18 and left home to start his life as an adult months before the accident. At the time of the accident, he had no health insurance. It is by no means an exaggeration when I say that without medical assistance, Adam would not be here with us today. Without MA, Adam would not have the chance of a continued recovery. Without MA, I would not have the heartwarming pleasure of watching Adam blink 3 times to tell me he loves me. By no means do I stand before you and tell you that MA is perfect, because it's not. What I will tell you today, though, is that MA is all that Adam has, and we would not be where we are today without it. I have a genuine fear of the current cuts to medical assistance, which I believe are $11 billion over the next 5 years due to the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. I have even more worse fears of future cuts to this. A wise man once said, as a nation, we will be judged how we take care of our least able. And I ask everyone here today, how will we be judged in the end? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rendell, please state your full name for the tape.
Timothy Rendell.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Any member have a question for this testifier? Okay, thank you again. The next testifier is Dan Zimmer and Kurt Rosen. Please come down. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Dan Zimmer.
My name is Kurt Rutzen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and representatives, thank you for the opportunity today to speak with you about the quality of services for people with disabilities. I'm fortunate to be director for Region 10 Quality Assurance. We work with counties in the southeastern part of Minnesota. For the past 10 years, we have been on the leading edge of aiding people with disabilities and assessing the quality of their life and licensing their services through a method called VOICE, Value of Individual Choices and Experiences. We believe that quality assurance and or licensing systems are most effective when they are implemented through a regional model that utilizes the strengths of everyone, people with disabilities, family members, direct support staff, and county case managers. We believe that the safety for people with disabilities needs to be the framework for a quality assurance system, but that there are also other important areas such as friendships, choices, and dignity of risk that cannot be ignored. We believe that quality is about outcomes and not planning. Most important is that the person is an active participant in developing what outcomes they desire to work towards. We believe that quality improvement comes from an engaged community and that our efforts need to be aimed at developing, strengthening, and challenging quality circles. Quality circles which include the person, family members, professional staff, case managers, and even sometimes teachers. We believe that issues need to be transparent to everyone in the quality circles so they can work on solutions together and hold each other accountable for expectations. We believe from sharing our experiences of voice throughout the state of Minnesota that our state is ready to take the next step in strengthening our statewide quality assurance system. In addition to working towards improving the quality of services in our region, we will continue to support other regions and statewide efforts by sharing our experiences, methods, and knowledge.
Thank you, Madam Representative. very much for letting us speak today. I want to share with you information about voice and my experience with it. First off, you can see that I have a disability. I have cerebral palsy. I'm very fortunate that I live on my own. I drive my own car and do about anything I want to do. However, this is not true for most people with disabilities. Voice helps people to be more independent and gives them a chance to tell their services what is important to them, what is happening in their lives. As a quality assurance team member, I get the chance to be involved with voice reveals. I bring unbiased observations back to the person and the quality circle and help improve lives. You see, voice looks at the quality of outcomes, not just written plans. Each voice reveal assesses the contribution and quality of support for all members of the quality circle. When voice highlights that improvements are necessary, the entire quality circle receives this information together and are required to work together to develop action plans for improvement. Sometimes voice reveals can bring dramatic changes. We have seen people choose to live in new settings, change jobs, and improve how the quality circle works together. Most times, voice reveals bring what an outsider might consider small, tiny changes. We have seen people be able to make more choices in what they are eating, what they are doing for activities, and who they are doing things with. We have seen people to be more involved in deciding what is important to them to achieve the person, not a bunch of systems. I know that what might be seen as a small change is not small to that person. What we should be focusing on. Every improvement is big. I want to thank you so much for your time.
I thank you very much. Thank you, all of you, for your testimony. Very moving, very informative. Thank you all very much. Any questions for these two testifiers, members? If not...
Comment?
Yes. Representative Hamilton. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. Bear with me, because I'm a little emotional. I understand how difficult it can be to come out and testify. 15 years ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I couldn't talk about it up until 6 months ago in public. So I just want to say I appreciate everybody coming down here and sharing your stories with us, with complete strangers, because I know how difficult it can be. So that's all I'm saying.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And again, thank all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm going to just make one comment that we do have a bill referral, and that is Representative Thiessen's House File 922.
Representative Murphy, do you want to? And as Representative Murphy is going up to the table, we're going to take up a few bills. I'd like to thank everybody else for everybody for coming out today too. It is really very helpful to us to hear this testimony and to get a sense of kind of what really goes on in people's lives. And I hope members, you know, this really I think needs to be a really top priority for us, trying to figure out how these systems ought to work better. Because we are at a different place, I think. We're kind of reaching a generational change here with regard to families and people with disabilities. And there's a need that we create options and choices for people much more than we have in the past. And I hope we keep that in mind and we can really move in that direction this session in the future. Representative Murphy, do you want to move House File 784?
Mr. Chair and members, I move House File 784 be passed with recommendation and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
So moved.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I ask for your support today for House File 784. This is a bill that will raise the medical assistance asset test for seniors and the disabled. It will raise the medical assistance excess income standard, meaning disabled and aged Minnesotans will no longer have to spend down into poverty to qualify for medical assistance and the health care that they need. When enacted, the bill will affect about 10,000 Minnesotans. The underlying principles for this policy change are equality, justice, and the respect for the dignity of all Minnesotans. With that, I want to introduce Mr. Joel Euland from the MS Society, and he will provide just a little bit more detail on the bill, and we'll take the questions. Thank you.
Mr. Euland, please identify yourself again for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, a coalition of about 100 disability organizations, a third of the organizations being advocacy organizations, two-thirds being provider organizations. We're here in strong support of this bill because this is what I would view as one of the core issues that drives a lot of public policy for people with disabilities. How much money they're able to keep and to qualify for medical assistance, it makes a determination not only for medical assistance, but it also makes a determination of how much money is available for housing, how much money is available for transportation, how much money is available for other services and clothing and other items that people with disabilities may need. I think as one of the earlier testifiers mentioned when you were talking about the Medicare Part D bill, Juanita Claire was mentioning that you have to live on $604. That's what she has to live on. For people who are on medical assistance, in most cases what we find is that they're living on about $613. That's 75% of the federal poverty guideline. The federal poverty guideline is about $817. And so when you think about that, people have to spend down to qualify. And what does spend down mean? Well, the average person with multiple sclerosis has about $1,000 of income that comes in each month through their Social Security disability checks. And what they have to do is they have to spend that on their medical care, prescription drugs, therapy visits, whatever the case may be, and then they're left with $613. So they spent $400 out of their own pocket. They have about $613 for food, rent, heat, electricity, and all the other essentials of life. And I think that for many people, $600, especially in the Twin Cities area, just to kind of put it in perspective, is probably something that people would spend at Target in a monthly in a month. And so, it's for people who have to live on just that amount of money for all their essentials of life, I think is very challenging. The other part of this bill is also relating to the assets, increasing the assets. The assets have not been increased by the legislature since 1983, the asset limits. That's $3,000 for a single adult and $6,000 for a married couple. When you figure $3,000 for a single adult back in 1983, that would be worth almost $10,000 in today's dollars. So I believe that our coalition believes it's time for a change. We're not seeking the change all the way up to $10,000 right away, but instead what we are proposing is to double the asset limits from $3,000 to $6,000 for a single adult and from $6,000 to $12,000 for a married couple. Finally, I did want to come back one more point on the income standard. What we are proposing is that we would raise it up so that nobody would have to spend into poverty to qualify for medical assistance. What we are proposing in this bill is that this would be done over a four-year period. It would be a 10% increase in the first year, so I'd raise it up to 85% of the federal poverty guideline, and then 5%, 5%, 5% to get us up to 100% of the federal poverty guideline in 4 years. And so that is the bill, and that's the proposal. I believe we have one additional testifier who can kind of speak about his personal experience on that. And unless there's any questions from the committee members. Any questions, members?
I do.
Yes.
Representative Everman. Thank you. I just have a quick question for the testifier. I understand nothing's been done since 83. Can you explain to us, if you know, how you came up with your proposed phase-in? You know, the numbers that you're proposing. Did you look at the surplus that's out there, or how did you come up with this proposal?
Representative Emmer, members of the committee, the reason we came up with the phased-in proposal, in 2005 we had a similar proposal in which we were seeking to go up to 100% of the federal poverty guideline in the first year. And when we got the fiscal note from that, it was not cheap. And so I think what we are proposing is that we wanted to gradually phase this in so that way we weren't, the state wasn't having to bite this one off all at one time. And so that's why we decided to do the gradual phase in.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Member.
Thank you. I understand it's not a finance committee, and my question obviously wasn't clear. Well, but then that is where I was going, is because it's a little different way of looking at it. I understand the phase-in. I understand the thought process for wanting to bring it on slowly, so you don't have to bite it all off at one time. But how did you pick these numbers as the ones that you think are appropriate for the phase-in versus something else?
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, I believe the way that we came up with this particular set of numbers is that we know that typically when the state does their budgeting process, they're looking 4 years out in this. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to take the biggest leap in the first year of 10%, and then from there on we wanted to just do 5% each year after that to eventually get us up to 100%.
So
it's nothing overly magical beyond that.
I think I answered it. It's numbers that you decided you liked.
Exactly.
Essentially. Thanks.
Representative Dowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, I'm wondering, you know, as we've talked as a committee about how to get people more coverage and more services, there comes this tug of war between private sector and public sector. And I'm wondering if you've done any thought about how many additional people this will put on medical assistance, which, by the way, committee members, our publicly funded health care programs are the fastest growing part of the state budget. And personally, I think we need to look at ways of limiting that growth and not accelerating it. But I'm wondering if you've thought in terms of how many additional people this will bring on medical assistance as opposed to perhaps other approaches of accomplishing the same goal.
Ms. Veelman. Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I guess what I would view in that with that question is I don't know that we're going to be bringing that many more additional people, even if we are at the poverty guideline and that people don't have to spend any further into poverty. I think that if you ask many people who are on medical assistance as a person with a disability, it would not be their ideal choice of a health insurance. Commonly with medical assistance, it's often referred to as the insurance of last resort. And I think that for many people with MS and other disabilities, if they're on medical assistance, it's because they haven't been able to get access to insurance through any other means.
President Gallo?
So we don't have any idea how many additional people this would bring on.
Mr. Chair, I believe that at this point, we haven't seen the fiscal note, and I don't know if the department is going to be reviewing that as they create their fiscal note when this goes to the Finance Committee.
It's a good question. I also think that part of this is not necessarily bringing new people onto the system, but not having them spend down quite as far, so they'll get on more quickly. Representative Abler.
Just to comment, I think I worked on this before, too. It's I'm a co-author, and this is a very worthy way to spend some money if we can find it. I think we use these terms poverty and stuff. The amount of money these folks have left after their 3 or 4 months' expenses, there's a whole new meaning to the word poverty. My teenagers probably have more money in their pockets to spend than they have to buy soap and the newspaper and so on. So it's a very worthy group, and I hope that we can find some way to relieve some of their challenges.
Thank you, Representative Aber. There's another testifier, unless there's other questions. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Larry Fairchild, and I was injured in a car accident. I broke my neck at C5 and 6. But with the spend down issue, I have been paying a spend down of $377, and it leaves me with $581 a month. And I went with a new agency because I was unable to pay my spend down because Social Security, at least I believe it's Social Security, we haven't found out yet, but Social Security said I didn't have a spend down for 8 months, and then they turned around and told me I had a spend down, and I'm not able to keep any money, so I have to get rid of the money. And that left me in huge debt, and I ended up filing bankruptcy, and the agency I was with still asked me to pay back money in that I couldn't afford to pay back. So they cut my program with them, and so I went with a new agency. And anyways, with that agency, they gave me a job so I wouldn't have the spend down issue. And the job pays me $70 a month after tax. I get $64.64. Well, I just got a letter from MAPD, and they said that I owe them $40 a month for working. And then, so that goes back 3 months, so I owe them $120, which I'll pay. And then my rent went up to $150 more because I no longer had a spend down. And the issue what I keep coming into with the spend down is the people on SSI never have to pay their cost of living increase to their spend down. And every year when you guys do raise the spend down issue, you don't allow the cost of increase to come on to that every year. And so that keeps going to my spend down. And so I never get that cost of increase living. And after a while, the people on SSI that it, even if they've never worked or they just moved to the state of Minnesota from another state, they get to keep usually around $80 to $100 more than the people with Social Security disability. So if any one of you guys were injured in an accident and got on Social Security disability, you'd be put in the same place that I am. And you would be left with keeping less money than the people on SSI. And I'm not saying that that's their fault. I just wish we could get the system going where it would be equal all the way around. And I definitely agree with the HF 784 because we definitely need the increase. I mean, because my cost, I've been living off of 581 before, so that's even less than the 636, which you guys said that we're supposed to be getting. And I don't know if all the Social Security workers really know what's going on with that situation, because a lot of us make less money than other people on the program. And I think somebody has to police that situation too, because things aren't going as fairly as it should be down there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members?
Chair.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I guess I totally get the part about the spend down, I think. But the part that I just want to hear a little bit more about is the asset limit. And could you just talk a little bit about, give sort of some examples of what difference that would make in terms of people's lives. And I also, just before you answer that, I just want to make a comment too, and that is that I think that when we think about this in terms of a safety net that any person in Minnesota could need at any time, it really kind of changes. And I think that one of the things that I found in my community during the campaign and that I hear from people is a lot of people kind of live in fear. Even if they have insurance, they live in fear of what could happen to them if they lose their job, if they have an accident, and so on. And part of that fear is that people realize that you have an accident. You could be in really dire straits, not just medically, but financially. And so I think that this is really an important issue, not just for those people who need it today, but it's that comfort factor for everybody. And I think that we all, those of us who don't need it now, have to kind of look at it and recognize that this could be any of us. So, but if you could talk about the assets, I would appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, on the asset question, let me put that one into perspective for you, because it is $3,000 that a person can keep in assets if they're a single adult, $6,000 if they're a married couple. That excludes your house and it excludes your car, and I believe it also excludes a burial plot, if I remember the law correctly on this one. But the what you run into here is that because this hasn't been increased in quite a number of years, it's very difficult for a person who is trying to live at home. And this is probably an area that I run into quite frequently for people with multiple sclerosis, is that if they do have assets, and they may not be rich per se, but let's say that they have $10,000 or $15,000 in assets and they are a single adult, you know, what we often see is that people with MS have worked and worked and worked. Even after they were diagnosed, they would continue to work because they wanted to do the right thing as much as they could. But then they got to a point where if they needed to qualify for medical assistance, that's when they needed to bring those assets down. And for a person with MS, the drugs that are out there for MS cost in the range of $12,000 to $20,000 per year. So you can do the math that within 1 year, in most cases, in many cases it's several, just a few months, they bring down their assets all at once that they work so hard to accumulate over, you know, a 10 or 20 or 30 year period. So that, I think, is one of the biggest public policy challenges in this particular area, is that people aren't able to keep their assets. And the additional part of that is that they can't, you know, try to be forward thinking as far as, okay, I've got a house, I've got to pay for that water heater that may break down, or, you know, those sudden expenses. When you only have $3,000, it doesn't give you a lot of flexibility for those unexpected expenses that we all face in being a homeowner or just, you know, in daily life.
Any other questions, members? Okay, Representative Murphy. And if I don't know if anybody from the department is here, but just to kind of, if we get some clarification on the issue that, I'm sorry, to the witness, I forget your
Larry Fairchild?
Mr. Fairchild mentioned about the SSI. If we could get some information on that, that would be helpful.
Yeah, Representative Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if they're referring to one thing that Mr. Fairchild said that jumped out at me, too, is the eligibility, you know, that the SSI coming into the state who maybe just got here are getting additional dollars versus where you're at. And I think it might be helpful, maybe if it's not just for me, and maybe this is what you were getting at, and I'm just looking at more detail, is to have some type of easy list of, you know, when are people eligible, when are they not eligible, and maybe that's already in our books and I can just be pointed out to it, whether it's out of state, out of country, all those things.
Mr. Fairchild.
Yeah, because I was under the, I actually thought the federal government was like, what's the word for it? I can't think that now. I'm kind of paranoid here. But anyways, discrimination. I called the federal government and said, why are you guys discriminating against me? And she asked, what do you mean discriminate against you? And I go, well, I'm on Social Security disability, and I get to keep less money than the people on SSI. And she said, that isn't the federal government. She goes, we're the ones that are giving you the check. The state is taking it away from you. And I thought that was pretty sad, because it didn't matter if you worked in the state of Minnesota all your life or whatever. It would just be taken away just like that, and you'd be left down, well, like you said, we're below poverty level on that. And I also have a friend that I forgot to mention. He's a veteran in that, and his veteran pay is $596, which goes totally to his spend down. He doesn't get to keep any of that. He pays a $1,386 a month spend down, and he's left with $470 a month to live off of. And, I mean, that's somebody that gave his life in the military for us, and he wasn't disabled in the war. Otherwise, he would have get keep more money because the veterans would allow that. He would be able to keep $5,000, I think he said. But see, now he wasn't injured in the war. He was injured in a car accident. So he's left with the $470 to live off of. And if it wouldn't be for my PCA, because I'm so good friends with her, and she's been my PCA for 13 years, she pays for a lot of the food that I can't pay for, because that's another issue. I don't qualify for food stamps. I just got a letter saying that my $50 food stamps was being taken away next month because I make too much money. And so I'm left with zero for food stamps, and I just don't understand how things are worked out down there. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, thank you for raising these issues for us, and we'll follow up on this. Representative Murphy, any other questions on the bill? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I urge your support and renew my motion for passage.
Okay. Representative Murphy's motion that House File 784 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Thank you. Representative Hosh. Representative Hosh, I will move House File 706 that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 706, I won't say this is a simple bill. We've heard that many times on the floor today. I don't think anything's simple, as you know. I would like to present to the committee also Author's Amendment 706A1. And would hope somebody could.
I'll move that amendment, the A1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Amendment A1 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The bill before you today is one that deals with MAEPD. As we know, there is an age limit currently for those who can receive MAEPD to the age of 64 years old. After that, you would have to then move to MA, which is under a different set of guidelines for assets and for inclusion of income when it comes to marriage. MA, you have to include your spouse's income, and MAEPD, you do not. The bill that I have would propose that an individual on MAEPD could continue to work, and also not only that, but the assets that they've accrued, whether that be total assets of up to $20,000 for that individual, or assets accrued within a retirement account, would pretty much be grandfathered in and be protected from the new asset limits under MA. I also have a testifier here who can give additional information, but really the crux of this bill is to encourage those to continue to work and to enter the workforce with those who are living with a disability. That is the crux of what we want to do here. We want individuals to be productive and to be able to work within the workforce. Right now there are disincentives for people to build up their assets, to build up a retirement, and then having to spend down after they reach the age limit when it comes to MAEPD. The second component of this bill also would direct the commissioner to ask for a waiver from the federal government so we can continue to have those who want to work after the age of 64 to continue to do so, and that would require federal approval.
Mr. Ewing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joel Yulin from the MS Society again. What I wanted to just add into this is that this is an area of public policy that we've been trying to address from an administrative perspective for a number of years, and it is kind of the suggestion that maybe the best way to address this is through doing bill language, and so that's part of the reason why you have this bill before you today. I think I also want to give you perspective on this program as well. Medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities started in after the 1999 legislative session. There's about 6,000 people roughly in Minnesota who are enrolled in this program. The number of people who are approaching age 65 is roughly about 40 to 50 people per year at this point. But like everything in life, as the baby boom generation gets older, that number will be increasing in the coming years. And so this is part of the reason why we want to address this and simply allow people with disabilities to be able to continue working past 65 if that is their choice.
Mr. Yulin, or Representative Hosh, the second point about working beyond age 64, we're going to need a federal waiver to accomplish that. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, and that is correct, is that we need a federal waiver for that. On the same year that the Minnesota legislature passed the medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, the federal government also passed the Ticket to Work and Work Incentives Improvement Act of 1999, and at that time, what they did was they had put a cap at age 65. What we're seeking to do is to see if we can get a waiver from that to allow people to continue working.
And Mr. Yulin, the administrative avenue you're pursuing was that as well?
That was kind of what we were pursuing, was to just see what options that we had to us, and this is something that we've been in the discussions with the department for probably about 2 to 3 years off and on, and it finally kind of came to the conclusion that maybe this would be a way to approach this one.
Okay, thank you. Any other, one more question. On the first part, which is retaining the assets, is that something we can just do now, or does that require a waiver as well? I'm sorry, I probably should have been paying closer attention.
This is something that we can, Mr. Chair, this is something we can do right now.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Wofford.
Mr. Chair, and to represent Hosh, I love the MAEPD program because it really does create opportunities to continue to be a productive citizen in spite of some challenges. But these transition points between programs are just so tough, and I'm glad that you're trying to help us think this thing through, because I heard one of the witnesses talk about, well, he wants to see fairness across the programs, and this becomes tricky because if someone were in that same car accident when they were 65, they wouldn't have the same options that this would provide for someone who happened to have had that accident a few years earlier. And so I'd like to keep working with you on trying to figure out how do we create amongst all these programs a decent standard of living for people no matter what their age is and what their circumstances, because I think we really do need to not lift people up and let them have a much more normal and independent life and then ask them to suddenly have a whole different standard of living and radically change the opportunities. But these transitions really are tricky.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Yulin, when they turn 65, how does this relate to Medicare payments?
Mr. Yulin.
How does the MA interact with Medicare?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, I think when you look at the Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities program, before they get to age 65, there's quite a number of people, and I don't remember the percentage right now, who are currently dual eligible. They're already on Medicare and also receiving the medical assistance benefits if they qualify for that. But right now, the way that it is that it doesn't interact directly with Medicare, because once they turn 65, they're off the program. So if you're wondering from the perspective of when they're qualifying for Medicare because of age, it doesn't make any difference, because you turn midnight and you have suddenly you're 65, you're no longer on MEPD, but now you do qualify for Medicare. If you're looking at it from the age perspective, not the disability perspective.
And Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I should also point out that some may have the need or choose to still be on MA for additional benefits included in that program, such as personal care. And that's one of the important aspects to this, that there is still a need that Medicare may not be able to meet.
Representative Norton. I think.
Well, I think too. I'm not certain. So,
well,
Chair,
can I go, Representative Gottwell?
Please do, and then I'll jump in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, good piece of legislation. I think this is a good program. I just wanted a clarification. I think the amendment you moved eliminates the retroactive provision, correct?
Representative Hosh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, I do not believe that it eliminates the retroactive provision. I'm trying to look here. The main part that we wanted to eliminate was the language from pages 2.31 to 3.2. Insert the new language, but we want to maintain the language from 3.3 to 3.9. It's just the numbering changes because of this new amendment.
I was looking at anyone that said page 3, line 8, delete everything after the period.
So it's eliminating, the amendment is eliminating the last sentence.
Yeah, it's eliminating the retroactivity.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, presenters, this is an area that's new to me, and I'm struggling a little bit. I thought I understood it, and then when the amendment came in, I'm confused. So I'm hoping you can just clarify for me. It appears that we're adding some new language, and I'm wanting to understand why we would disregard a spousal income in determining this. So that appears to be new to the language, and I'm just looking for clarification because I'm not understanding why we would do that.
Ms. Henry, if you could please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center. The answer on disregarding spousal income is that those are the rules on MAEPD when a person is under 65. So what we're trying to do is carry on as many aspects of the MAEPD program as we can for people when they turn 65, since we're blocked at actually allowing people who turn 65 to keep on the program, we're trying to bring in all of the aspects possible. And one of them is you're considered a household of one so that your spouse doesn't have to impoverish him or herself. I don't know if that helps.
Representative, I think it does clarify the policy decision we have here. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. We're just simply trying to continue current practice at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Norton? Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And, Mr. President, before you go, Representative Laffa, do you have any witnesses here for your bill?
Not that I'm aware of.
If I could just ask the audience, are there any witnesses here on House File 705?
I guess.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hosh, how many individuals are on MAEPD right now?
Representative Hosh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, approximately 6,000.
6,000?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, members? Okay, Representative Hosh, do you have any last comments? Or we can go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee, I just thank you for your time. I know that we're all busy right now, and I appreciate your support. This is the right thing to do, and we want to encourage individuals to be participating in our workforce and also not create as many disincentives as we can, and this takes away one disincentive.
And if I can ask one last question. So the idea of spousal income in the MAEPD program itself is to not provide a disincentive for the spouse to go out and work as well. Would that be accurate?
Mr. Chair, excluding the spousal income simply is, trying not to have a marriage penalty within our current system. And with the transition from MAEPD to the guidelines under MA, which includes the spousal income, could create complications within that relationship and really, I think, are unneeded. And we don't want somebody to separate just for assistance needs.
Representative Huntley?
We already heard today from another witness that had to get divorced in order to survive, and this would prevent them from having to do that.
Okay. Thank you. If seeing no further questions, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 706, is that right? 706 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. As amended, thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Loffler, I think we're going to carry over till Thursday on your bill. So members, we are adjourned.